your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Cinephiles Live here on the Cinephiles YouTube channel on this Sunday afternoon, at least here on the West Coast. Thank you to everyone who's joining us. Sorry we're a few minutes late, but I am John Rocha, that is Steve Morris, and we were having some conversations before we started about where we're at in the world, and we just wanted to kind of finish out one of our impromptu shorts that we did not record before we started the show. But thank you to everyone who's joining us. Steve, how are you? How are things? How's your Sunday?
I'm doing good. It's funny to me that now you and I just chatting is really a short. Sometimes we record it and sometimes we don't. But if we sit and chat for a while, that's a short.
Basically a short, absolutely. But yeah, we are here to talk about Stephen King adaptations because of the Long Walk that is out in theaters this weekend. I got a chance to see this film last week and really enjoyed the movie. Surprised how well they took this early Stephen King. It was the first thing he ever wrote, The Long Walk there, that was included in the Bachman Books compilation, and turned it into a movie that featured some great performances from Cooper Hoffman, and from David Johnson, the two main leads of the film. Judy Greer in this as well. Steve, have you gotten a chance to see this one yet, or is it on your list?
I did. I actually, it was a little bit tough to schedule because my kid had a sleepover. So it was like, oh, right, drive his friend home yesterday, rush to the AMC in Burbank. And I saw it yesterday. I really liked it. Yes. I think it's a really good movie.
Were you surprised at how well they adapted the film, made it work, and even made an hour and 50 minutes in essence, walking down this road, walking over 200, 300 miles, I think it was, made it tense and stressful and didn't pull any punches on the violence, and also offered some really powerful and sadly, when you consider this week, topical social commentary about our world.
So I haven't read the book, so I have no comparison to make to that particular book. But I think this is the kind of movie we need for me, because what it is, the story, the basic idea is completely absurd and ridiculous. Yeah. But once you get past the absurd and ridiculousness of it, it affords you the opportunity to talk about all this stuff and to create all this drama in a way that I have never seen. There is no movie that is like The Long Walk. And just cinematically, of the whole thing is people walking in one direction together and they cannot stop. Suddenly you have to, well, how do you film this? Like, cinematically, it's totally unique. And in terms of just all of the issues in humanity that you can get into, and frankly, I agree with you. By the time I won't spoiler what the ending is, but what happens in terms of how you see characters that seem somewhat cardboard cut out, when you start, by the time you get to the end, you're like, oh, this is complicated, and it really, in its totally bizarre way, is a movie about finding ways to resolve your differences because we're all in this together.
Yes,
that's what the movie's about.
You're so 100% correct, yes, initially judging people, but also as you spend more time with people, starting to understand what their motivations are to be the way that they are, why they are the way that they are. So it's about understanding people, not excommunicating people, which I think is a fascinating change that happens throughout the movie, because we're all in this together. So in a way, it's symbolic of what's going on in our world. We're so quick to judge, dismiss, rule out, throw away, push away, and immediately vilify certain people for the way they act, the way they talk, the things they say, instead of trying to understand what has led them to be in this place and what they, and if there's any value to what they're saying, simply because they have a different point of view than you have. And so by the end, in a way, the walk itself and everybody involved in the walk symbolizes America to a degree. And then
the world.
And the world, right. Yes, I'm sorry. The world. Yes, of course. And then you have someone like Mark Hamill, who is essentially the authoritarian figure. And as Steve said, if you make it the world, all throughout the world and throughout the world's history, there have been authoritarian figures that essentially promise something. If you do this, if you go along with their plan, you'll receive this. But a majority of people in the world have never received the things they were promised by these authoritarian dictators. It's all about control. It's all about using people to achieve their needs. And I think that came through by the end of the movie as well, you know?
Well, and you also get into this thing where you can meet someone and go like, I don't really like that person, and, yeah, and put them into a box.
Yeah.
And then, and this is the thing, you, I mean, honestly, our little off mic conversation that was not a short that we had right before getting to this, you know, part of it is like, we live in this moment where we vilify, we're dividing everybody into good and evil. And we're like, okay, who's on the good team and who's on the evil team? Right. But the reality is 95% of the time, 95% of the people are just trying to live their lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's going to the grocery store. They're just worrying about their kids. They just are trying to make ends meet and pay their rent. They're just trying to get a day, you know, a day off to go sit and watch football. That's, we're all the same.
Yeah.
We're on the long walk together. And yeah. There's, but the 5% of us, of that part of us, might really piss each other off.
Mm.
But that's paying attention to that 5% and not paying attention to the all the other stuff we're doing that's the same.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And that comes through. But you know, moving away from the themes and the messages within the movie, the performances I thought were excellent as well, Steve. As I said, Cooper Hoffman, David Johnson, really leading the way. But all the young actors in the film I thought were fantastic. Judy Greer rarely gets to play a role like this. I've seen her occasionally do dramas, but it was great to have the moments that we had with her. The only drawback I thought was a little bit Mark Hamill. I thought to myself, what if Gene Hackman had that role? That would have been amazing to see Gene Hackman in a role like that. So, but overall, I thought the performance has knocked it out of the park. And there's a lot of people speculating that David Johnson could be the next Black Panther, could be the next James Bond, possibly. There's all kinds of possibilities throughout. So what do you think of the performances here?
First of all, that central relationship is so great. It's one of the great, you know, I've said many times that, you know, the Maturin-Aubrey friendship is the greatest friendship in all of literature. Mm. We've said the only comparable friendships to me are Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and particularly Kirk and Spock. Yeah. This was a great friendship, yeah. You know, like it's one of those friendships that from the moment they meet, they get each other on some level. But it's not just that, it's that they keep surprising each other and they keep surprising us.
Yes.
Like I didn't know there was at no point in that movie did I know where that their relationship was going to go. Right. I really didn't, you know, so that was fantastic. As far as the Mark Hamill thing, I think the director, whose name I have forgotten at the moment,
Francis Lawrence. Yeah,
that's right. I think he didn't give himself enough credit. And this is what I mean by that. Mark Hamill's fine. It doesn't interfere with the movie. I don't have a problem with it.
Right.
But what his casting seems to me is it's very much a cartoony villain like you would get in a Frank Miller comic book in the late 80s.
Yeah.
Particularly with the glasses, which are very sort of Frank Miller-ish in terms of the iconography. And so this is like the evil bad guy, the Major. That's what it feels like. But what I think he didn't realize was he was making a movie that was so much more human and subtle than that initial image. And so that's why Mark Hamill doesn't, I agree with you.
Right,
I think a more serious actor would fit better.
Yeah.
Because that's not the movie he ended up making. The comic book one.
And I think Mark is a perfectly fine actor, but I do think Mark at times is a limited actor. And I think that you're absolutely right. I think there was a better direction that could have been implemented here that mirrored the energy of the entire movie, the vibe of the entire movie, if you will. And you're totally right. It's a much more subtle film, and he comes on almost cartoonish at times because it's so outlandish, because these people that do become in charge in these kinds of situations are much more charming and much more nuanced than you might think, which is why they achieve the things that they achieve. So yeah, for sure. Yep. And Francis Lawrence, fantastic director. Constantine, The Hunger Games, you know, he's really coming back into the forefront now as a director, which is great to see. So I don't think this one's doing that well at the box office, but it is a damn good movie if you guys want to give it a shot.
Agreed.
Yeah. All right, well, we're here to talk about Stephen King adaptations, some of our favorite Stephen King movies. And Steve, you know, there are so many to choose from, so many iconic characters, so many iconic moments. You know, you go for something like Carrie, which was the first adaptation that was done on film, and you go all the way through to like Dead Zone, and you've got Cujo, you've got Creepshow, which is a nice little fun compilation, Stand By Me, which is an iconic child's film, Dead Zone is up in this thing, Shawshank Redemption, The Shining, so many Misery, so many fantastic films. Hell, I'll even throw in Dolores Claiborne, which I thought was fantastic. And even now, Running Man is being remade with Glenn Powell in the role of the Arnold Schwarzenegger character there. And of course, who can forget Christine, which is one that a lot of people have told me about this week that I need to watch, which I've never seen. So there's so many great ones to choose from. Tell me, I don't know if we've talked about it on the Cinephiles. I don't remember every episode we've done, but like, what's your experience with Stephen King? Maybe refresh some of the people who are tuning in possibly for the first time.
So I think there's a damn good chance that I've read more Stephen King than any other author there is.
Well, to be fair, there's so many works. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, yeah. I've said Patrick O'Brien's my favorite, but I've read 25 books of his. I've easily read 40 Stephen King books. Yeah. I was looking at there are 30 in my Audible library. Wow. So he's been a big part of my life forever. And what's interesting is that for me, because I'm a scaredy cat, and didn't want watch horror movies. My first experience with Stephen King was seeing Carrie, definitely when I was younger than I should have been when I saw that movie. but my first really falling in love with Stephen King was I was going on a road trip with my buddy Jeff, and we're in the store, and I see an audiobook on the shelf, and that is this right here, the book on tape. Of the Gunslinger.
Yeah,
get in focus. Doesn't want to be in focus. That's weird. But it's the Gunslinger audiobook from 1988.
Wow.
Book on tape. And I will keep this forever because that got me into the Dark Tower series.
Right.
The Dark Tower series is totally mixed in all sorts of ways. Yeah. Some good, some amazing books, some not so good books. But that formed my love of Stephen King. And then it went out from there, and I read everything that I could find from, not everything. I shouldn't say that. I didn't read everything because there is tons, I've read Stephen King over and over and over again in all sorts of genres.
Yeah. I have to say on my end, I can't remember what it was that sparked my love of Stephen King, but I know it was when I was at a young age, like in my early teens, maybe 11, 12 even. Maybe I saw Dead Zone and really loved Dead Zone, or I'd seen The Shining by this point maybe on TV. And so I'd gotten into Stephen King, and I rented books from the library there in my small town of Virginia and would just read them religiously. And then as I got older, in my teen years in high school, I found out about him having a pseudonym, Richard Bachman, and I got those books. And those books put the hook in me good, because it showed me that he is able to function in these smaller formats and still deliver a powerful story. And I remember reading The Long Walk, and it was so intense. And, you know, the film is a different ending than the film and than the book. And I remember Rage, which is about a school shooting, a kid who loses it and shoots and tortures his classmates. And that just was so well written. And so I just was fascinated how this guy was just born to write and born to keep creating stuff. And of course, you get older, then you read all the stuff like It and The Stand and all the big stuff, you know, and he's still churning out books to this day. So clearly a guy who's driven, and he's become like an icon for us, right? Because remember when the car accident happened, people were just like, oh my God, Stephen King possibly died and all this kind of stuff. So it's been such an important thing. And you know, he's delivered a lot, or he's been the foundation for a lot of really good adaptations of his work. And there have been some bad ones, but I think overall there have been some really great ones and some classic films throughout, Steve.
But it was crazy, so I had to look it up. The number one source of cinematic adaptations is the Bible, with thousands of adaptations. Number two, got any guesses on number two?
Who, number two? Shakespeare?
William Shakespeare, with hundreds of adaptations. Number three is Stephen King.
Wow.
Yeah. The next closest, like Stephen King has well over 80, and it's even more when you get into TV and stuff. The next closest is Charles Dickens, who has a few dozen.
That makes sense. Oof.
But so that's, you know, and then after that, you get to like J.K. Rowling and some other people. But like, no, Stephen King, in terms of movies, there are other, you have to go to Shakespeare and the Bible to have more adaptations than Stephen King.
That says something. Well, because horror is universal, and he found a way to write horror in a way that was accessible, yet still very much intelligent and fascinating. And I think I don't think there are a lot of authors that can do that, let alone a lot of horror authors that can do that. And so in a way that appeals to multiple generations over and over, he's like the Beatles almost, right? People keep rediscovering, or Elvis or what have you. people keep rediscovering that music every generation, just like the new generations discover Stephen King, because the way he writes is very evergreen. All of that stuff he writes is very evergreen, and they're fun to read when you get a chance to read them, for sure.
You know, what's crazy? I know I recommended to you that Miracle and Wonder, Paul Simon book by Malcolm Gladwell.
Yes.
And the thing that he says about Paul Simon, which is so, it's very few people, is that Paul Simon was an important songwriter in the 60s, an important songwriter in the 70s, important songwriter in the 80s, an important songwriter in the 90s. And then still 2025 is still doing things that people respect. There are very few artists that remain relevant over that many decades. Mm. And Stephen King is definitely one of them.
Yeah.
He still puts out books, you know, 50 years later that people are not, that aren't just popular, but people are going like, no, this is an important book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. And you know, the thing about The Long Walk, which is the first story, as I said, he wrote it when I think he was in high school or in early college. And people, when they read, when he finally published the book, people had said it's the most cynical view of the world that he'd ever had. And as a young man, you know, growing up through Vietnam, which is what this book was, Long Walk was inspired by, is the story of Vietnam and the draft and all of that stuff. You can see that that is what the point of view was at the time. Sin, I think for all the darkness in his books, there's always a hope. There's always a happy ending, possibly. There's always a something better, right? The kids overcome the clown. The kid outlasts his father at the Overlook Hotel. The man dies in the dead zone doing something to stop someone from blowing up the world. You know, there's always like this positive ending amidst all this madness and this horror. There's always still a hopefulness to Stephen King's books, which I also think is the secret ingredient of why people enjoy them and going back and reading them.
I think that's definitely true. I mean, I think, look, Stephen King writes a lot of books.
Yes.
And so, and not all of his books are great. And there are times, even with it, it's so funny because I'll have this experience where I'll be listening to a book and going, oh, this is okay. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. We're kind of in areas I've been through before with Stephen King.
Right.
And then suddenly the prose style will hit and you're like, oh, wow, there's something here. And this is the thing that I think people who don't understand Stephen King, because like, I'm not a horror guy. I don't like to be scared. Right. If Stephen King couldn't write beautiful stories about the human condition and explore ideas that were really powerful, or write great action, which he totally does, you know, like, or set up great gothic situations or draw interesting worlds, I wouldn't read the books. If it was just horror, I wouldn't be into that. And The Long Walk is a perfect example of like, now like I said I haven't read the original material, so I don't know how much is in Stephen King's, but it's like, it's an idea, and then within the idea he gets to play with the human condition.
Which is so great. And his characters are so fleshed out, so interesting, and so connectable when you're reading it as a person. I mean, Needful Things is one of those books that when you read it, you can't help yourself but look at addiction in a different way, look at the way you can be manipulated for the things that you want, and how far are you willing to go for these things, and are they worth it once you get them? So there's so much about Needful Things that appeal to me that I love. And then you look through all his books that have these fascinating characters and interesting characters, complex characters, and they challenge you as a reader. Like, to, do I like this person? Do I not like this person? How much do I like this? Or do I understand this person? Where do I fall by the end of the book about this person? You know, is there sympathy for the woman in Misery? Is there sympathy because she's so unhinged in what she's doing and she does terrible things, but is there sympathy because she's allowed herself to be in this place? Do you feel bad that she's in a place like this? So there's so much about his books that challenge you as you're reading them to ask questions about yourself and ask questions about how you look at other people in the world, which I think is yet another thing that's great about his books.
Well, he just loves stories. I mean, that's the thing, you know, about him, is that he loves living in the world of stories, you know, and it is interesting because he's had so many movies made of his work. What Stephen King great book does not translate well to a movie, and what Stephen King property actually makes a great film, is a really interesting question.
Yeah. And it is, I don't think you can generalize in any way, shape, or form with this stuff, because there are some great books. Like Needful Things, I think is a great book. Movie's fine. It's not great, but it's fine. But it could have been incredible, that movie. So it all depends on who is directing it. It all depends on who they get in it, how they adapt the original novel. And if they not, and if they get it across the line the way they need to get it across the line, you know, and I think that's what's great about the thing. Well, that's what's interesting about when you look at these kinds of things. What would you like to talk about, Steve? Do we have questions from any of the fans before we start jumping into this stuff, or shall we jump?
Well, since we're talking, we actually do. We should announce this right now. We are officially changing some of our Patreon policy right now.
Oh yes, yes.
Because what we've done in the past is basically when we came to a big movie like Jaws, mm-hmm. being an important one, we would put out to our supporters on Patreon at the $10 level or above that they can submit their questions. And people listening heard a lot of those questions that we did in the podcast, which was a lot of fun. And it was so much fun that we went, well, why don't we just do this for every movie?
Yeah.
So what we're doing from now on is that for everything, including live shows like right now, we'll announce it ahead of time. And if you're on the $10 or above level, you can submit your questions and we'll answer them hopefully in the live show, which means like if you're thinking about spending $10 on a super chat or Streamlab or something like that right now, you're much better off investing that $10 in a $10 Patreon level, because then you can ask questions for every movie down the line. You could just always ask questions. And then what we're going to do is if there are questions we can't quite get to in the live show or in the regular podcast episode, once a month, where we're going to record a special recording where we cover all the other questions and discussions that came up after we put the movie out. And that too will be available to the $10 above level. So that's some stuff we're adding to our Patreon. And speaking of which, I have a question right here.
Oh, yeah.
Which it comes from a user who I think this user said they didn't want their name read.
Okay.
But the question is, and it relates to what we were just talking about, as a new user to Audible, what is the first Stephen King book you both recommend me listening to? Also, ooh, what Stephen King movie was better than the original material?
Oh.
All right, so let's start with, do you want me to start with the audiobook?
Yeah, sure, please, go ahead. Yes.
So obviously I'm an audiobook obsessive, and I do love the Dark Tower series. But for me, there is one book to rule them all. It is the most important Stephen King book for me personally, and that is On Writing. On Writing is his book. It's half autobiography and half just his thoughts on writing. And for me, this is the number. I probably have listened to it at least 10 times.
Wow.
This is anyone who has any aspirations of being a writer at all, this book is number one, with Bird by Bird by Anne Lamont being number two. That's number one thing to go to on Audible.
Can you read that question again?
Yes, I can. Please. What Stephen King book would you recommend me listening to on Audible? All right.
You got away with your technicality. You got away with your technicality. All right.
That's, I mean, it is a Stephen King book on Audible.
Exactly. It is, so it counts.
You're like, I'm going to take Morris down, man. I'm going to get him.
I was going to say, I'm forcing you to answer one of the fictional novels, but yes, On Writing is a great choice.
I did start by saying the Dark Tower series I do love.
So the Dark Tower one is the one that he would recommend outside the On Writing one. I would recommend The Shining. I remember listening to that. I rented the cassettes from the library to listen to that, because the way it's told and the way it's written, it lends itself to a very unsettling, yet you can't turn it off, type of experience. And so I highly recommend The Shining. I know it's kind of a cop-out to use that one. The other one I think you could throw in there is The Stand. The Stand is an incredible Audible book. Yeah, I remember listening to The Stand years ago, and I was like, oh my God, this is so incredible. So, and someone recommended, Ryan Charles Lieb said Carrie Sissy Spacek reads Carrie. So there's an audio book of her reading Carrie. That would be fun to read as well.
It's really good. I have it. And it's also, what's so funny, because I hadn't read Carrie, I probably read it 5 years ago or something, is that I didn't realize that it is an epistolary. Which is, it is a book written in letters and articles, not in prose.
Oh wow!
And diary entries and things like that. And it's really good. So as I usually do when we do these live shows, I try to watch a few movies to catch up on stuff. I said I should watch Carrie, which I hadn't watched in a long time. I'm not the biggest Brian De Palma fan. I appreciate that he's a talented, great director in many ways, but I don't tend to love his movies.
Yeah.
I got 20 minutes into Carrie and I literally went, you know what? Fuck this. I don't want to watch this. I'm out. Like, I know what the story is. I appreciate the movie. I get it. I'm done. I just said, there are other things I can do with my life. There are 80 Stephen King movies I can watch. I don't need to do this. And I walked away.
Well, there goes Brian De Palma being on our show. We'll see.
I know he was clamoring for a slot.
Guys. Yeah. Okay. So what's the second part of the question? What's a better movie than the film? Is that what it is?
Yeah. What Stephen King movie is better than the original book or material?
Ooh. Oh, that is tough.
Can I just say to Vincent Zawada, who said that he disagrees that the movie is not, he says, love Carrie, disagrees, Steve, that movie is so good. I am not saying the movie's not good.
Right.
I'm saying it is good. I'm saying I didn't fucking want to watch it.
Yeah, he's saying horror. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I don't know if I can say if there was a better adaptation film-wise than the book itself. I mean, maybe you can say Shawshank, because it's a good novella, but it's nowhere near as powerful as the movie is. So I would say Shawshank Redemption, to, you know, have a populist answer. That's my answer, because it's so much better than the novella, but not because the novella is not good. It's just that they can flesh it out more in the movie. You know?
Yeah, there's no comparison. I mean, the Shawshank, Rita Hayworth in the Shawshank Redemption and as a novella is perfectly fine. But I wouldn't have read that and gone, this is one of the great stories. It took Frank Darabont to turn this into one of the great, it is one of the great films. The other one I'd say, which is, I think, is from the same collection of novellas, is Stand By Me, which was The Body. It's like, Stand By Me is a lovely coming of age story. The Body is a nice short story. Like that's the area. Well, I have, as I said now the third time, I have not read The Long Walk. Mm. I am 100% certain that movie is better than that book.
I will tell you, overall, it is better than the book, but the novella, whatever it is. But there are moments of the novella that are a little more powerful than the movie, because you can pull less punches in print than you can on screen, especially when you're showing what in essence are teenagers teenagers, as they're played in the movie, getting shot in the head in essence randomly throughout the film. So that's an element of that as well.
So, John, I don't know about you, but there can be a lot of problems that happen in the bedroom. And while Hims can't fix your scratchy blankets, the noisy neighbors, the bad temperature in the room, or the cat that won't leave you alone, when it comes to performance, Hims definitely has you covered.
This isn't a one-size-fits-all care that forgets you in the waiting room, Steve. It's your health and goals put first, with real medical providers making sure you get what you need to get results. When you think of Hims, think of Hims as your digital front door that gets you back to your old self, with simple 100% online access to trusted treatments for ED and more, all in one place.
So to get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/cinephiles. That's hims.com/cinephiles for your free online visit. hims.com/cinephiles. Actual price will depend on product and subscription plan. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Steve, we are in the height of summer right now, and fruit is all over the place to enjoy at the farmer's market and in other places there. And, you know, it can be hard to eat healthy without feeling like you're giving up flavor or fun, because you have so many restrictions, so many requirements on this kind of stuff. But Washington Red Raspberries is something you and I have been talking about. They're a clean, simple, and seriously delicious way to add more nutrition to your day. What has been your experience with these Washington Red Raspberries?
Well, if you think it's hard to convince yourself to eat healthy during these hot summer months, imagine trying to convince a 14-year-old who really, really likes a whole bunch of stuff that don't include fruit and vegetables to eat healthy. Well, our new program for my son Jackson has been a smoothie a day every single day. Wow. And the main ingredient of those smoothies has been the incredible red raspberries. Not only are they sweet and delicious, but that incredible taste allows me to maybe
also include a couple of vegetables or a little protein or some other healthy stuff that my son needs. So these Washington red raspberries have been an absolute godsend to my family.
Yeah, and the frozen Washington red raspberries, Steve, are one of the best kept secrets in the freezer aisle. They're naturally low in sugar, high in fiber, and support gut health, blood sugar balance, and overall wellness, which I think is good for anybody, whether they're a 14-year-old kid or old fogey like you and I. So if you all want to discover new ways to use American frozen red raspberries and get more details on where you can grab a bag of these delicious berries, go to redraz.org. That's redrazz.org. You'll find recipes, health tips, retail locations, and everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine.
Look for Product of the U.S. on the bag.
Save big money on your roofing project at Menards with Owens Corning Shingles. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements and enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning Duration Shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 24 colors of Owens Corning Duration Shingles and transform your home today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Well, what are some? Well, let's get into some of your favorites, and then we'll swing back to some more questions from our patrons. But what are some of your favorite adaptations? What's the one that's like stick with you, Steve, throughout the years, and that you maybe go back to watch that are not Carrie, that you go back to and watch and sit down and enjoy?
So, for me, I mean, obviously, we just talked about one. Shawshank is one of the great films, and it is one that you can. Back when I used to switch channels, The Shawshank Redemption was one where if it was on, I would stop and watch it.
Yeah.
100%, no question about it.
Yeah.
You know, the ones we've done on the show, The Shining is a fantastic film and one from the early days of the cinephiles that, you know, maybe we'll have a redo at some point because it is an amazing movie.
Yeah, I would love it. Yeah, I think The Shining is absolutely one of my favorites still, and we've talked about that documentary over and over again whenever we talk about The Shining, but it's because to me it's always tied to it. It's like that little smaller novel that's attached to the bigger novel when they're trying to sell them together sometimes. But that film is still resonates. The direction within that film is still poignant as hell from Kubrick, and the performances are just top dollar. And we just recently, I think, lost Shelley Duvall. And so she's so great in that movie. I agree with you on Shawshank. Absolutely. I would throw in Dead Zone. I thoroughly love to go back and watch Dead Zone. Every time I catch it on Pluto TV or at least watch 20 to 30 minutes of it, Walken is great. Book Adams is great in it. Martin Sheen is chilling in it. And you throw in Herbert Lom, who to me, when I was growing up in the 70s, he was the bumbling chief of detectives in the Pink Panther series. So to see him play a much more serious character in this film and bring that voice of his to life the way he does in the movie, it's damn good. And you know, subsequently it's been remade. The Anthony Michael Hall series I thought was good as well. And so, yeah, I love The Dead Zone as one of his adaptations. And of course, Steve, go ahead.
I hadn't watched Dead Zone in a long time. So I watched it in the last week. Mm. What's interesting, it's really good. And it's so funny because it's that rare Chris Walken lead role.
Yes.
That really works. The thing about it that I hadn't occurred to me until I was watching it was the weird similarity between Stephen King and another New England author, which is John Irving,
is that
both Stephen King and John Irving are obsessed with destiny. So if you look, whether it's Prayer for Owen Meany or Garp or The Fourth Hand or all these or Cider House Rules, there's always a sense of destiny that you have to go this way and this is what has to happen. Yeah. Dead Zone is exactly that. Everything is leading towards a specific destiny. The Dark Tower series is like that. The Stand is like that. It is like that. That is a very common thing where you'll have a Stephen King character going, I don't know why I need to do this, but I know that I do. And it's fitting into some piece, you know, of a pattern of a destiny that has to be fulfilled in some way, you know?
Yeah. And you see that throughout that movie, because a majority of the movie is him not wanting to use this gift that he's been gifted and not follow his destiny and not adjust his life to now accept that this is his life. He spends so much of the movie resisting the changes in his life because of what it cost him in the relationship with Brooke Adams, which is so beautifully wrapped up by the end of the movie in a way that you don't expect, and it's shocking, right, but touching, so touching. That, yeah, it's, that's such a great point you bring up here, Steve. What about some of the funnier ones? What about Running Man? Do you enjoy Running Man? Do you enjoy, or Christine, which I think has a lot of elements of humor within it, even though it's pretty terrifying, kind of a dry run of the, or kind of similar to The Road that Stephen King did, or the duel, a duel rather, that Stephen King did a few years earlier. And then you have Creepshow, another one that with has horror, but a little bit of humor within it as well. What do you think about those kinds of adaptations?
It's so funny how movies moved in and out of our lives, you know, back in the 80s in the VHS era, because I, every Arnold was just a regular thing. I saw Arnold, we saw Raw Deal, we saw Commando, and of course we saw Running Man. I watched it over and over and over again. And you look like you're frozen up. So I don't know, maybe I'm frozen up or maybe you're frozen up, but I'll keep talking and we'll see what happens. Creepshow was one of those that was always on the VHS rotation. So it was always on in the party in the background. I don't think I ever watched the whole thing from the beginning, but I saw all the pieces as we went through it. And Christine, I've seen parts of it. I don't think I've ever watched the whole movie. And you are frozen. So I'm going to keep talking. Hopefully you'll come back. I guess I get to go on and talk about other Stephen King things. Yep. Hold on, I'm texting John now. I think those, it was so interesting, those 80s movies, particularly around Creepshow, that Stephen King just became a go-to person that we would see things from all the time. I'll say also, like, just the one that I hadn't watched that I watched in the last week is Dolores Claiborne, which is an astoundingly good movie, and very much like The Long Walk in the sense that it's not exactly a horror movie. It's a drama, a character drama. And man, Kathy Bates' performance in that thing is absolutely astounding. So I seem to not have John, and I haven't heard from him. So hopefully maybe his internet is just down. But I think I'll take a couple of questions here. Vincent Zwada, thank you very much. You said recent ones, you love Dr. Sleep and the Pet Sematary remake. I haven't seen either of those. Going back over here to the comments, let's see what else we got going on here. The other thing I think about Stephen King is his... Oh, I'm just hearing back from John. Yeah, his internet is apparently down. So hopefully we'll see him soon. We're going to decide exactly what we want to do. Vincent, I see you talking about the 2017 version of It, which I didn't see. I thought about watching on an airplane once. I remember the Tim Curry one, which I absolutely loved, and I loved the book, but I have not seen the 2017 It Chapter 1 and Chapter 2. It's really interesting, all the stuff about The Shining, because you have this thing where on the one hand, it's one of the great films. And on the other hand, the dude who wrote the book doesn't like the actual film. Oh, look, we're finally my hero. It was not good. It wasn't. I'm not going to say that was good. That was bad.
Okay, I apologize, everybody. My internet just went down here on the West Coast. San Diego heat, I think, affected the internet, so sorry about that, y'all. That was weird. Anyway, what were you saying, Steve? So I could chime in.
I was saying so much. I was rambling endlessly while I hurriedly texted you, going, "Help me!" Trying to come up with things to talk about. The one thing I did mention while you were gone was one of the movies I watched, which I had never seen, is Dolores Claiborne.
Oh yes, yeah.
And man, that's a good movie. And fucking Kathy Bates.
Yep.
That performance is astounding. Yeah. It's so good. And it's such a movie where it's not a horror movie. It is a human drama, you know?
Yes. Yeah. The horror is having someone like that be your husband and your father. And
absolutely.
What that does to your life and what that does to your relationship. And I think the reason that movie isn't more revered or cherished by Stephen King fans is because Misery came first, and A Misery with Kathy Bates came first, and it, and Claiborne doesn't, you know, it doesn't quite match the Misery, but it's still, as you said, a fantastic film. Her and Jennifer Jason Leigh, these are two incredible actresses going toe to toe. And then David Strathairn playing a role where he rarely gets to play a, like this kind of an evil dude. He is so scary. And then the mystery of it all, because you're really on Jennifer Jason Leigh's side initially. And then as things start to unravel, you just kind of see, wow. And at the time when that film came out, you know, we weren't showing domestic violence in quite the brutal ways that we'd seen in a mainstream film like they showed in this movie. And I think it woke a lot of people up to this kind of stuff that's happening in our, in people's homes, and probably still happening in people's homes, right? But at the end of the day, it's also just phenomenal performance from both of those actresses in the progression of their relationship, you know, and what happened. So yeah, pretty good stuff. I agree with you as well. What about It Chapter One? We that came out. I only want to talk about Chapter One. I didn't like Chapter Two, but if you'd like to chime in on Chapter Two, feel free. But did you think they did a fantastic job transferring a film that that had a really great miniseries behind it in the 90s? A lot of people love, and made it appeal to generation or to the new generation now in the last few years.
Well, unfortunately, I just revealed while you were offline that I actually haven't seen It Part One. I kept meaning to, and I haven't seen it. So, yeah, so I have, and nor Part Two. Of course, I saw the Tim Curry version back in the day, and I've read the book, but no, I haven't watched it.
Oh yeah, that's one that I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed. And you and I are both Freddy cats, and so I was hanging off the theater ceiling watching that movie. So I'll be curious to see what your experience with it is like, because there are some genuinely super scary moments.
Well, that's why I haven't watched it, John.
Fair point. Fair point. Let's see. There's some other ones here that we've like. Oh, what about? Cujo or Children of the Corn? Sorry, Firestarter. Any of those appeal to you when you're growing up? Like the dark half, getting into the '90s stuff.
That's where it's not my thing. Firestarter is the one that I watch the most.
Yeah.
Because in this weird way, it's a superpower movie. You know what I mean? And so, like, that attracted me to it. But like, I was forced to watch Children of the Corn at a party in 19 whatever, you know, and it was scary, and I had to pretend not to be scared so I didn't look uncool in front of my friends. And I, you know, I've seen Cujo, but I did not seek out these movies. I mean, that's why it's like the I'm not a horror guy, but I love Stephen King's books, not because they're scary, but because they have great characters and great stories. And the ones, the movies that I like are the, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Misery, Shawshank, Dolores Claiborne, like Stand By Me. These are The Long Walk. These are movies where, yes, there are definitely scary elements in some of them, but it's the human elements that actually is what draws me to those films.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the essential success of Stephen King, is the way he, you know, captures humans and what they're going through in those respective books, and unearths some of maybe our more quieter impulses that we don't talk about or we don't show to people. He shows them within the characters that he has in his books and how they confront and experience a thing. And sometimes, which I really love about his books, is that there's characters who make mistakes in selfish moments and then later on have a chance to have some sort of redemption or make a different choice. And some of them do and some of them don't. And I think that's very realistic of the world, you know, and I appreciate that about his stuff as well. But we get into the 90s. What about Stand By Me, man? Let's talk about that film. I mean, how I feel like that was a seminal film in me as a young teenager, watching that in the theaters. I mean, just so many fantastic people involved in this. You have those four kids who, of course, Rivers passed away, but all three of them are still, Jerry O'Connell is still hosting, still acting. Corey Feldman still, recently had a book. And then, of course, Will Wheaton's out there as a Star Trek guy. And then you throw in Kiefer Sutherland, Casey Shamasco, and Richard Dreyfuss doing the voiceover of the film. So what are your thoughts on, and Rob Reiner? This is a Rob Reiner film. So what are your thoughts on that?
So, I mean, I have always said, I think Rob Reiner's first run of seven films is among the greatest seven films in history. Mm. And people do not talk about it because it's Spinal Tap, The Sure Thing, which is a light but really well-made, you know, kind of young romantic comedy. Then you go into Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men, and The American President. Mm. Like, That is a hell of a run of great, great movies. And yeah. Stand By Me is like, it really, because you've got Spinal Tap, which is its own thing. And right. then you have The Sure Thing, which is a light romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. Stand By Me is where you start to go like, oh, Rob Reiner is a director.
Yeah.
Like, this is a real movie. And it's also in that era. There's that era of movie soundtracks, you know, yeah. that goes, that kind of starts in my mind. It starts with American Graffiti. And then you have things like Animal House and The Big Chill. And you go into the 80s where you have Footloose and Flashdance and all this stuff. Well, Stand By Me was one of the soundtrack movies.
Yeah.
Me. Like, I had that cassette, played it in my car all the time. And it's in, you know, that resurgence of that era. Yeah. I think it's a lovely, lovely movie.
Yeah. Dirty Dancing soundtrack also having some old fun. Yeah. Yeah. I think everything reached the peak in the double disc Forrest Gump soundtrack that had so many songs right. from really different decades, which was fantastic. Yeah, I agree with you. I had the Stand By Me cassette as well, and I learned about some of those older songs from the movie. But the movie itself, again, a fantastic film that captures a universal experience for kids. Not that people find dead bodies all the time, but more a matter of four kids who are coming from, like, you know, not the greatest of homes, finding a camaraderie, a brotherhood amongst each other as they go out and experience something together that challenges them and unsettles them and scares them, and how they find a way to stand up for each other and be there for each other, even though they have judgments about each other within their group. They find a way to stand up against a common evil, which is Kiefer Sutherland and his crew. They're chasing him down. So and within that, you have these really poignant conversations between these kids talking about their worlds and their lives and how they've treated each other, both good and bad, which I think is essential to that film working so well. You know, a universal experience a lot of us have growing up at that time, just going off on your own. You know, it ain't like nowadays where your parents have a monitor on you all the time, you know, and whatever. I can't even imagine. Being a parent nowadays, for God's sake.
Well, no, and they honestly, kids aren't having these experiences because 12-year-olds aren't going off to wander in the woods all day by themselves.
Well, they are, but it's in a video game.
Yeah, it's in a video game. Exactly. It's in a virtual space. Hey, would you like another question from our patrons?
What do you got?
This comes from Cinephiles Advisory Board member Jeff Cook, who asks, which book needs to be made into a movie, and why is the right answer The Eyes of the Dragon?
I'm not as familiar with that one as his other film. Do you know that book, Steve? I don't know.
I absolutely know The Eyes of the Dragon. Okay. I love The Eyes of the Dragon. So this is The Eyes of the Dragon was essentially the fairy tale that Stephen King told to his kids when they were little kids that he decided to write into a book.
Oh, wow.
It is. I'd read it many times, and then I read it to Jackson when he was little.
Yeah,
and it is so good, and it gets really, really redundant. There's just this point where it's kind of overwritten, but it is Stephen King trying to write the classic fairy tale, like the prince who's in the prison, and the evil wizard, and the conspiracy, and this plan, and it is great. I'm totally with Jeff Cook. This would make it not only a great movie, this is a great animated movie, I think.
Oh, wow. Shit. I don't know what my answer is to this. Well, I have to look at his works, right?
I have a second answer if you want a little bit more time.
Sure. Yeah, give me a little time. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, my second answer is the Dark Tower series. It is a series. It needs to be like the way we're talking about Game of Thrones or something, where it's like every season of the series is one of the books. And you do it over a lot of, because this is a big, big story. I mean, that you know, Idris Elba movie is a fucking travesty. It is just so terrible. Right. And to really go like, okay, we're going to try to figure out how to do this massive, epic world, you know, hopping story of the Dark Tower, that's a big job.
I mean, The Stand, that was a TV movie, right? So, or TV series?
They've done it twice, right? It was a TV movie. It was a miniseries in the early 90s, I think.
Yeah.
And then there's a more recent one, right?
Yeah, I guess that would. So they've already done that one. I guess there was a Tommyknockers, right? I think Jimmy Smits was in that one, if I remember correctly. So, damn, there aren't a lot. Yeah, that Dreamcatcher. Oof, I thought that was going to be a lot better. Yeah, I'm looking through. I don't know if I can answer this question as well as I would like, because I think everything that I've read, they pretty much adapted. Maybe Rage, I guess, the novella that is in the same book, the same Bachman book collection with The Long Walk. I've always wanted to do that as an adaptation, like, or seen it as an adaptation. And I don't think I've ever seen it. I think there was a TV movie in the 80s or something like that, that did a version of it. But I would like to have seen it, especially now, as we see, sadly, so many school shootings going on in our world. I think this is something that could absolutely be explored by the right director in the right framework. You know, so I guess that would be my answer to Jeff's question. All right. Is there another one? Have we got another question?
I do have another one. This is from someone who I can see is actually in the chat right now, which is Ryan Lieb, who asks, is more directed to me, just so you know, but he says, okay, in your film school experience as a teacher, have you yourself or any of your students taken advantage of Stephen King's famous Dollar Baby arrangements? And if so, can you tell about it? I don't know how many people know about this, but this is basically, Stephen King has sectioned off a bunch of his short stories and said any student or aspiring filmmaker can make one of these movies for the price of $1.
Wow.
But the agreement is it has to be for non-commercial uses, so you can't sell it. Okay. So it could go to festivals and it could be used in educational purposes. Mm-hmm. And they have to send a copy to Stephen King. And that's the whole deal. And so they're all, and that's how Frank Darabont, who later made Shawshank, that's how he first met Stephen King, was he did a $1 version of one of his short stories.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but to answer Ryan's question, no, yep, none of my students have ever done it, and I have never done it.
Oh, I wonder if Rage is on that list. I'd be down to do that. Oh, all right, cool. All right, well, there's the questions here. Yeah. Well, let's look at Stephen King's other stuff. Yeah, Insomnia was a great book. Did you ever read that one?
I did, yes. Well, and that, no, because here's what I did, because this is the kind of crazy person I am, which is that there are all these, you know, the Dark Tower is sort of the center of the Stephen King universe. And there are all these little connections. And because we have this lovely thing called the internet, you can go and see every single connection. And so I decided I was going to read every single connection to the Dark Tower. So there are connections in Hearts of Atlantis, there are connections definitely in Insomnia, in Salem's Lot. And so I went through all these books, and it is so funny because I had read the whole Dark Tower series first, and you meet this character, I think in the last book, that is a character that comes up in Insomnia. So I'm reading Insomnia and then go, oh, that's why they said that one thing at that one moment in that book. So yeah, and Insomnia is another one where there is a destiny. It is specifically about, we are heading towards this moment in time where I think there's like going to be a big explosion at a speech or something. I don't remember what the details are, but that's what, and we have to cut off that destiny from happening. Well, and this is the other thing too, is that the Randall Flagg character, which is the bad guy in The Stand.
Right.
Flagg is also the bad guy in Eyes of the Dragon. Right. And he is also the man in black from the Dark Tower. And he is also connected to the low men, which are who you see chasing people in Hearts of Atlantis.
Yeah.
Like this is, there is, that's why I, you know, there is a Stephen King cinematic universe in a weird way, because so many of these stories are actually subtly connected to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating. I think, well, I also think another thing that I like about Stephen King's books, and I wonder if we can maybe wade into this a little bit, little slight minefield, is that I like that he's unafraid to include political questions within his books. You know, he deals with abortion in his books. He deals with, as we mentioned, domestic violence in Dolores Claiborne. He deals with these things that happen, the government versus citizens. He explores this stuff, as you saw in The Long Walk and in other books as well, and the responsibility that we have to deal with that stuff and the horror that comes from those real things that happen in our everyday life or things that we confront in our everyday life. And I kind of appreciate that about Stephen, that he pulls no punches and speaks freely or portrays freely issues that are going on in the day, you know, and you mentioned insomnia, and insomnia has to do with, was it like abortion rights or something like that? So there's elements of that in it, if I remember correctly. And so I like that he doesn't shy away from this stuff. And part of the gutsiness of his books is that he's willing to wade into these minefields and show you characters dealing with the complexity of these issues, you know?
I think you have to give King credit for tremendous courage. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, particularly, I mean, just the, you know, the guy almost died from getting hit by a van, you know, and brought his, you know, himself back. But he's still to this day, just today, I saw a tweet from him. He's politically engaged in the world. And the thing I like about him is that, and I think it's really reflected in his writing, is that he's honestly trying to do it right.
Yes.
And this is the thing, is that I think, you know, far too often we expect perfection. Did you say this in exactly the perfect way? And his characters are muddling through life, and he is trying to create, and he cares, like there's a character in the Dark Tower series who is a split personality, and it's an African-American woman. And one of her split personalities is the most cliched, vile, angry, and every single foul word you could possibly imagine comes out of this character's mouth.
Wow.
And it's like, here's the white guy from Maine who's writing this totally over the top cliche character. And it's like, would I write a character like that? I probably wouldn't, you know, because there's this weird thing of like, well, are you getting this right? And what does right mean? And what rights does a white author have to portray this character? And what I think the thing I like about Stephen King is he's honestly trying to do the best job.
Yeah.
And he's okay with people going, I don't like what you did. He's like, that's okay. Yeah. And then he tries, just talking about the tweets, he had said something not quite right. And then he came out and apologized and corrected what he said.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the thing, is that that's what I mean by being an honest person trying to do his best at the job. So, the thing is, like, the idea that we should stay away from politics is like, politics is in our life. The Long Walk has elements that are like things we face in our life. We need our artists to sometimes stumble into these issues so that we can learn about them and talk about them, but they won't always get it right. And that's okay. You know,
We used to be okay with that, you know, and so. Yeah. I hope we come back to that place again where we create more space. You know, everyone's talking about grace. Well, it all starts with you. Can you give the grace to the situation? Can you understand what happened? And as you said, do you give credit for someone realizing their mistake and apologizing immediately? Is there space for that? And nowadays, it feels sometimes like there isn't. So that if you make a mistake, you can never apologize for it. You're now branded this. And you must carry this forever, even though you apologize for your mistake or walk it back. How much of grace are people willing to give them? And it's ironic because the same people unwilling to give them grace are the same people who are who themselves require some grace at times and seek grace at times in their own lives. So it's just that kind of thing. So you see it throughout. But yeah, I appreciate the gutsiness, as you said, of him being able to do stuff like that as well and walk into those issues and play them and portray them so well.
I just to quickly bounce off what you were just saying is that all the time you hear people talking about acceptance. We need more acceptance. And you, all the time they're saying, you need to accept me more. And they're not saying, I need to be more accepting of you. That is the big, is that if you want someone to accept your wacky, crazy thing, then you have to accept their wacky, crazy thing. That's it. That's what acceptance is. Not a thing you demand. It's a thing you give.
Right. Exactly. Yes. 100%. Going into the 90s stuff, Steve, are there any of these adaptations that have stood out to you that are some of your favorites? Let's run through them real quick. What do you got? Like, The Dark Half, as you mentioned, Graveyard Shift. We already talked about Misery. We already talked about Needful Things. The Mangler, Dolores Claiborne. We talked about that. Night Flyer, Apt Pupil. Speaking of politics, ooh, the Apt Pupil. And The Green Mile. I mean, there's love for The Green Mile, right? Isn't that a fantastic adaptation that gave us some more Tom Hanks, some more?
So, once again, you are frozen, and I'm hoping that your internet isn't going down. John, can you hear me? Well, we'll see. I'll answer your questions though.
Am I on again?
Okay. Oh, you're back.
Sorry, guys.
That's all right. So, okay.
Yeah, first sorry, of all, guys.
But when you list those, you know, straight up horror movies from the mid 90s, I didn't see any of them. That's when I was in film school.
Oh, wow.
I don't see. Okay. Yeah, I don't seek out horror movies, you know, just for to be horror movies. But the other ones I've seen, Green Mile is another one I rewatched. That movie's so good. It's a really, really good movie. I also think watching, I was like, look, if you are confused about what the magical Negro trope means, the Green Mile is the only. And it's no disrespect to Michael Clark Duncan, who is fantastic in the movie. And I don't think it's not, I don't even think it's disrespect to the movie. I think that is a honorable, you know, honorable movie trying to tell a great story that is troping up that trope more than that trope has ever been troped. But the movie totally works. Tom Hanks is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's really a good film.
Right. Right. Exactly. Well, because I think the thing is because I think it dances with a cliche in a way that doesn't become cliche because Tom Hanks doesn't start out as a racist, right? And a lot of times the magical Negro is used to teach the white character about how to be better in the world, right? Bagger Vance.
Well, that definitely does. I mean,
Tom Hanks' character is already a good person.
He is.
Yeah. So it's not, there's not much farther for him to go. But maybe it reaffirms his faith and his relationship with his wife and things of that nature. But I think it's the other people that are involved that maybe, you know, are punished, you know, because most of the times the magical Negro doesn't also lead to someone ending up with brain damage and muttering to themselves for the rest of their lives because of their evilness towards the magical Negro cliche or trope or character. So I kind of like that it turns it on its head a little bit, but you're absolutely right. It's very clear that's what he's playing with there in the book and in the movie, for sure.
I think what's interesting about that movie, it's very much what we were saying about The Long Walk, which is you're taking this mystical thing, you know, like there's this guy who has this magical power, and that's the hook that makes this more than just a death row movie. But what it's really about is these people living in this world and here, and again, like The Long Walk, where you're in this situation of tremendous violence.
Yeah.
What the whole community, it's all about this community coming together to help each other on death row. It's exactly like The Long Walk structure. Not, it isn't, of course, it's different, but this is the gift of Stephen King, is he hooks you in with this mystical or crazy or violent or scary idea. Yeah. But now that we're here, we like you're in Shawshank. Now you get to talk about hope, you know?
Yeah.
In the Green Mile, now you get to talk about justice and goodness and sin and forgiveness and kindness and all these other things, and you're doing it on death row, you know?
Yeah, yeah. A place where you would normally, you know, judge these people as unworthy of grace, as we were talking about earlier, unworthy of understanding, you know? And I love that as a challenge for you as a viewer. What about the 2000s? You have Hearts in Atlantis, which I've never seen. Dreamcatcher, which was just painful to watch and signaled that Lawrence Kasdan could not do it anymore. Secret Window from David Koepp, ironically. Or Riding the Bullet, 1408. The Mist, which I still haven't seen. And then you get into Mercy, The Dark Tower, Gerald's Game, 1922. Any of those that strike you as some of your favorites or ones that you enjoyed or anything like that?
As you listen to those, I'm like, oh, I don't think I've seen any of them. Because I watched five movies leading up to this. But as we said, there are over 80 Stephen King movies. So I have no comments. What are your comments on those films?
Yeah, I mean, I think Secret Window was an interesting watch, but I think the 2000s, early 2000s, and some of the 90s is not really the best time to see some Stephen King adaptations that really capture the best of it. Even The Mist, which some people really love, is a bit of a divisive adaptation for some people. And 1408 didn't really do well, although some people do like it. And Dreamcatcher was just an utter mess. I thought that was such a waste of a film. Hearts in Atlantis, I think, is a sweet film.
I did see Hearts in Atlantis. That's the one I've seen.
The Hopkins one, right? And it's fine, but it doesn't.
It's fine.
yeah, it doesn't radiate like great Stephen King adaptation in my mind. But certainly I wouldn't fault anyone who's listening to us who enjoys it or loves that movie, because there's some sweet, really sweet touching moments in that movie as well. And Hopkins delivering like a tender performance, which he rarely gets to deliver. Yeah. You know, like Shadowlands, Hearts in Atlantis. There's only certain films where you really get to see Hopkins in a tender way. You know?
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned Apt Pupil.
Yes.
Which I think is a good movie. You know, it's this weird Bryan Singer world.
Yeah.
But that short story, which also I think is in the same book with Shawshank,
that
is one of the most fucked up and disturbing short stories I've ever read in my entire life. Apt Pupil is so, and I will never, ever read it again. It's exactly the experience I had when I started watching Carrie. I'm just like, fuck this. I don't even do this.
Yeah. As we get into the later 2010s here, there's another version of Carrie that comes out, of course. Mercy, The Dark Tower, and then It, Chapter 1, Gerald's Game, 1922, Pet Sematary, which I thought wasn't a good remake. It, Chapter 2, which just missing the magic. Dr. Sleep, which I need to see and I still have not seen that one. I should absolutely watch that one. Another version of Children of the Corn, another version of Firestarter, The Boogeyman, and recently The Life of Chuck, which a lot of people liked, but a lot of people didn't like as well, with Tom Hiddleston came out last year, Salem's Lot, which didn't really do that well. There was The Monkey earlier this year from Osgood Perkins, and then, of course, The Long Walk, as we've been talking about. So any of those appeal to you, or any comments on those, Steve?
No, I mean, I've already said, Dark Tower is it's terrible. There's also things like there was the Under the Dome miniseries, which I thought it's funny. The book is good. There's a certain level of Stephen King books that I think are great books. Yeah, there's another level, we've talked about it with comic books, where it's like, I'm going to just say it in a gross way, but just there are certain comics where it's like, if you read it while you were on the toilet, that was perfect use. And there's a fair amount of Stephen King where it's like, it's fine. You know, I'm perfectly happy it's enjoyable. It's well made. I'll get what I want out of it. It's not necessarily going to be great. And I feel like, you know, Under the Dome, the TV show, it was like that. It was totally fine. You know,
right. I Vincent Zawadis's Gerald's Game is awesome. Highly recommended for both you guys. I didn't know about Gerald's Game. I didn't know there was a Stephen King adaptation until Jeff and I did our top 10 Stephen King adaptations on the Hot Mic earlier this week. And I had never even knew that Gerald's Game, I think, was a Stephen King movie. And then someone explained the plot to me, that it's Carla Gugino going off to have, I think, a honeymoon weekend or a weekend of sex with her husband or lover.
Yeah.
And he dies while she's handcuffed to the bed. So how does she, when no one knows she's there, how does she escape that situation? What can happen? So that is fascinating. So I kind of want to see if that film, or maybe I should just read the book first and then see if the film is any good, you know? So, you know, we were talking earlier before we got on the mic that I'm probably going to walk away from being on social media so much. That's going to open up some time for me. And I think reading books is going to fill that time again, like it did when I was growing up, and maybe adding some more books to read, putting them right there by my recliner will be getting old. It will be the way to go. And Gerald's Game, I'll have to add to it for sure.
I think the fact that humans, the changes we're going through in a very short space of time are crazy. And we went from a world where a lot of people read to a world where very few young people read.
Yeah.
And that scares me a lot. So I'm glad that you're going to do a little less social media and a little more books. I think that's good for all of us, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I I'm tired of reading social media. I want to read books. I want to get lost again. I want to discover stories and be entertained and thrilled in that way as well. And maybe Gerald's Game will be one I add soon. All right. Anything? What else? Oh, well, yeah, we should have some more questions. Any more questions? Oh, wait, no, actually, let's take this. What about the TV adaptations? The Stand, The Langoliers, The Shining, Desperation, and then there were elements of Under the Dome, as you said. Mr. Mercedes had that. And then, those are the, and the Salem's Lot, there were adaptations of Salem's Lot. It, we spoke about already. Nightmares and Dreamscapes. The Dead Zone, which I mentioned earlier. 11-22-63, which some people really like. The James Franco one, where they go back in time to the Kennedy assassination. And then there's Creepshow, The Stand, which was the one in the 2020s. Yeah, right, exactly. So any of those adaptations? We mentioned the It one already. So any of those TV adaptations did you watch and enjoy?
First of all, I haven't done 11/22/63. I keep meaning to. I love that book. I think that's a really, really good book. Yeah. It is. It's what's so seductive about that book is that we want to save Kennedy too. That's what it's about. Can I go back in time and stop the Kennedy assassination?
Right. Right.
And the stress, and it's really clear that Stephen King, you know, was as obsessed with Oswald and the Kennedy conspiracies as you and I have been at one point or another.
Yeah.
Because him going back in time, he's hitting all the spots, all the places, meeting all the people whose names you know, trying to stop. And it's just such an upsetting book. So I'm very curious about that miniseries. I mean, The Stand, the first Stand miniseries back in the day was a huge, huge event.
Yeah.
And then in general, I think most of these, I haven't seen most of them. I watched the Shining one.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's so hard with The Shining because you're going from a masterpiece of a film made by one of the greatest directors of all time.
Yeah.
But the author of the book doesn't like it, to something the author of the book does like.
Yeah.
But it is not a master of filmmaking, you know, made by one of the great masters of all time. So,
And you're going from Jack Nicholson to Steven Weber, and that's a hell of a precipitous fall, in my opinion. I love Steven in Wings, but he is not Jack Torrance, in my opinion. So we look at it. Now, what about, let's, I know we don't like to be too negative. Are there any terrible adaptations besides Dark Tower? I mean, I would throw Maximum Velocity in there. Are there any bad adaptations, or have they just been pretty much middling to great, to good to great? Is that your feeling about these?
I could say, I think, you know what a classic critic thing to say is, is, you know, all those movies I didn't watch, they're probably bad. But I actually have got, you know, this is the thing. I haven't seen all those movies. My guess is if I watched them, I would find a lot of bad ones.
Yeah.
You know? And even a movie like Running Man, you know, that I love for camp reasons, that's not a good film.
No, you're right. It's a campy, fun
film. It's Running Man.
Yeah. Him and Maria Conchita Alonso, which is hilarious on so many levels.
I mean, who doesn't love Maria Conchita Alonso?
I know. At a time when they weren't casting Latinas in leads, she was carrying the ball for sure. She walked so that J-Lo could run.
Particularly in that jumpsuit she had to wear.
Hello. Let's hit the final questions here from the people who sent them in. Any more of those Patreon questions, or shall we hit some of these?
No more Patreon. I think we did get some Streamlabs, or I know that I saw some of those coming in.
Vincent Zawada said, recent ones I love, Dr. Sleep and the Pet Cemetery remake. All right. I'll have to give Dr. Sleep a watch for sure. I'd be down with that. Fantastic314 says, hey, Cinephiles, Christine is probably my favorite Stephen King adaptation. It inspired me to name my truck Christine. It survived shopping carts and hailstorms and came out unblemished.
Listen, if that's your truck's name, long may Christine live.
Yeah.
Bless her.
Long may Christine live for sure. That's awesome. Yeah. Christine was great. That's the guy from, Back to School, Keith Gordon. I think he's in.
You're totally right. Yeah.
Yeah. So had a little run there. All right. Let's hit these Streamlabs as well. Alan Smith, he says, hi, Cinephiles. Would love to hear your views on the Stanley Kubrick, Shelley Duvall controversy on The Shining. Many people feel Kubrick was abusive, while others feel the issue has been exaggerated over the years. I love Kubrick's films. He just did too many takes. Well, I mean, this is like Salieri comparing that there are too many notes in, or the Emperor comparing that Mozart has too many notes. What do you think? We talked about this on The Shining, I think, Steve, when we did our breakdown of the movie, but we can rehash it. What are your thoughts on it now, all these years later?
There's no question in my mind that it's abusive. I mean, like all the stories I've heard, they're terrible. They're terrible. Yeah. And I mean, the too many takes things, that we don't know what the other 87 takes were that he didn't like that got him to 88.
Right.
My guess is that I, as an editor, I'm going to look at 30 of those takes and go, this would have been fine, you know, but I don't know, but I'm not Stanley Kubrick. Right. I do know that he made, you know, Scatman Crothers, you know, practically lose it, you know, fall apart on take 90 that he was doing with the scene with the kid where they're like eating ice cream or whatever, you know, like, and so, and the stuff, you know, the manipulation, the yelling, all the stuff he did to Shelley Duvall is totally fucked up and awful.
Yeah.
Her performance is amazing. Could she have gotten to that performance without an abusive director? I don't know the answer, you know, like, yeah. But no, I don't like it.
Yeah, I don't like it either. And I don't think it has been overblown. I think people have tried to hide it over the years. So as a counter to people trying to hide it, there's been more talk about it and a highlight on it, especially because, you know, we're becoming more aware of how female actresses have been abused on sets for decades. No matter what the current political movement is or belief is, women are still being abused on film sets. Women are still being abused at places of work. Men, even more so now, we sense this attitude coming back that women are beneath them, unfortunately, and that's going to cause more of this kind of behavior in these places. And women are going to feel less inclined to push back or fight back or defend themselves if they don't sense that there's a place that will actually believe them when they tell these things that happen. So Shelley Duvall, it's not like she was constantly bitching about directors abusing her on sets. She was very specific about this thing with Kubrick and what he did. And just because we love his movies and he's our hero or what a cinematic hero or whatever, it doesn't mean he's devoid of criticism or immune from criticism. Quentin Tarantino has some uncomfortable situations with women on his film sets, and I've called them out on our show because why not? No one's untouchable. No one is unassailable. And so I think it's fair to call this stuff out and highlight it and make people aware of it, you know? And so, yeah, that's the way I feel.
This is what we were talking about with Stephen King. And it's also kind of what you and I were talking about off mic earlier, which is that we have this idea now that people are either good or evil. And then you look for, and you go like, oh, Kubrick was abusive to Shelley Duvall, so cancel him. He's done. He's evil. He's a bad person. It's like, no, Kubrick did this stuff. And I can say, I don't like that stuff that you did.
Right.
He did this stuff over here. And I can say, I do like that stuff you did over there. And that's what the discussion is. It isn't about finding the bad guys. It's just about, I can like that and not like that. So I can say, hey, you're a great fucking director. And you did a movie that was against nuclear war, which I really believe in. And I think that's really important. And then you did this movie about The Shining, which I think is a great film. And I don't like the way you treated this person. So let's try to do the good stuff you did more often. And let's do less of the bad stuff. That's the conversation we should be having.
Ironically, he is a Stephen King character, right? In one of his books. You see him doing terrible things, but you see him doing these other things are the results of his things. And I think the fallacy with stuff like this too is that, like, oh well, look at the movie, it was great, so he was valid to do what he did. And that's nonsense, because you have, as Steve said earlier, we have no idea if he hadn't done those things that Shelley Duvall wouldn't have still delivered that performance, you know. And it's the same thing with Charlie Chaplin and his films, the numerous takes he did. He's not somehow immune from criticism because he made these great comedies, you know, and it's, he's also not, it also shouldn't be like, well, he's valid because they turned out and made great comedies that he put his actresses or actors through 100 takes or whatever. It's nonsense. And I think it speaks negatively of a director that needs that many takes to get the right take.
That's what I think. It's like, what the fuck are you looking for? You know, like, well, this is the legend of Stanley Kubrick is that he knew exactly what he wanted, and he was doing 90 takes because he had to get exactly what he wanted. But I actually think the reality is he didn't know what he fucking wanted a lot of the time, and he's trying to find it. That's why he's doing 90 takes.
Yeah.
And this is the other thing. It's the ability to just go, I like this, I don't like that, and let's have a discussion and move forward, rather than, you know, putting everything on this. You know, everything gets consumed by these issues, you know, and that's not how we should do stuff.
I mean, how would people who like his multiple or many takes, would they like it if you heard the story that a Hollywood executive sat on set and made Stanley Kubrick shoot the take 90 times or shoot the scene 90 times because he wanted to see what he wanted to see? You would be so upset if someone said that to Stanley Kubrick and the film turned out well. Would you also validate that executive for forcing Stanley Kubrick to shoot a scene 90 times because he wanted to see what he wanted to see? I mean, that's how you got to look at it. You know?
Totally. Well, and do the opposite story, which is probably more likely. The executive comes on the set and says, you have to stop at 30 takes.
Yeah, right. Would you be happy?
You know,
exactly.
Which, you know, it's like, and the thing is, we can't know. Like, we can't know what Jaws would be like if the shark had worked. We can't know what The Godfather would be like if Coppola wasn't constantly under pressure to be about being fired. Like, yeah, we can't know what Mad Max Fury Road would have been like if they didn't deal with all the problems that they dealt with. Yeah. Like, we can't know, you know, like, yeah, again, you know, it goes to the thing I was saying before about 95% of the time people are just living like people. 95% of the time, a director's just trying to get his fucking movie made. And they're making all these decisions in the middle of stuff. And sometimes they're stressed and sometimes they're angry and yeah, sometimes they're, you know, exhausted, and they do a thing. And then that results in other things. And that's why you have a, you know, you have a postmortem and you go, okay, here are the things we did that worked pretty well. Here are, yeah, some things maybe we shouldn't have done. And then you move forward, you know? Yeah,
exactly. Let's move on. Hopefully these other answers aren't going to take us 30 minutes to get through, but we'll move on to these other three questions. Justin Toner says, hi guys, I got into King's work after the 1990 It miniseries and read the book and read most of his 20th century work, but haven't read any in years. My top five King films are Shawshank, Stand By Me, Misery, It from 2017, and The Dead Zone. Wow, I can't believe It Chapter One is 2017. Oof, that's insane.
This was Justin. Yeah. Justin, you should go. Yeah, yeah. You should go back and, you know, try out Salem's Lot or Carrie or some of the older, yeah, books. There's a lot of good stuff in there, you know.
Dude, yeah, The Dead Zone is a great book, and The Shining is great. Don't let the slight campiness of the 80s movie fool you. The Dead Zone is an excellent book. The Shining as well. Yeah, for sure. I can't recommend any of the newer ones because I haven't read any of his newer ones in a long time. So I'm with Justin on that. Alan Smith says, I love the Mist film, but I'm not a fan of the quote new ending that was not in the original story. Being that this is the last feature Darabont directed, did the ending put him in director jail? The Walking Dead is also part of it. Is Darabont toxic now? Oh, I don't think he's, I don't think, I don't know.
Why would he be, why would he be toxic? Is there some horrible story about Frank Darabont I don't know about?
Well, I think there were stories that he was difficult to work with on the set of The Walking Dead, and so he was removed as showrunner.
No, I remember that happening.
There's a lawsuit as well. So, yeah.
Again, it just goes to the difficult to work with. That could mean everything, but from being a complete horrible asshole,
yeah,
to being completely fine and somebody just didn't want him around.
Yeah.
Like, I you know, he made two lovely movies. He's right. Done some other good work. He's not taught. Yeah. Unless it takes a lot, for, as you know, for me to go, okay, I'm done with that person.
Right. And I think from what I'm reading here, Darabont settled the lawsuit for $200 million between Frank Darabont, CAA, and AMC. So I think Frank's fine. Frank's going to be fine.
Yeah, Frank's fine.
Yeah, exactly. If you might say he might be in director's jail, but I think you're in director's jail until you come up with something that is really exciting and interesting, and then you get out of jail. That's how it works, you know? And so perhaps he is in director's jail a little bit, but he also put himself in that jail by being difficult and possibly on sets. So he's got to get himself out, you know?
Maybe this is one of the definite weird ones is that Shawshank is not a successful movie in the box office, mm-hmm, but is frequently listed as one of the most beloved films of all time.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it is put on very, very high up on lists. Green, yeah, Mile, Oscar nominated film,
yeah,
a really, really good movie. And then he's involved in one of the most successful TV franchises in history in The, right, Walking Dead. And the dude doesn't have a career. Like, yeah, it's really weird to me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't he also do the the kind of modeling or what's the word it's not modeling and it's not cheesy. Like, I've heard this word before in the past, Steve. Treacly? Does that make sense? T-R-E-A-C-L-Y?
Treacly. Probably treacly.
Yeah, what's the definition of treacly? I think that might be what I'm getting at.
I wasn't prepared for definitions today, but I believe treacly means sort of sickly, insidiously sweet.
Yes! So,
and I believe its word origin is from like a treacle tart, which would be a British dessert, I think. But again, I did not prepare for this at the moment, so that's my best shot.
Okay, well, I'm saying that because I think he did The Majestic, which was, opinion, treacly. It was overtly sweet. It was Jim Carrey wanting to do drama, you know, with Truman Show and Eternal Sunshine. And it didn't really work. And I think that's when people maybe started to turn away from, because I mean, like, you're right. After The Majestic, he does one episode of a show called Reigns, which is 6 years later, one episode of The Shield in 2007, then does The Mist. So from 2001 to 2017, he didn't direct a movie for 16 years. And then The Mist comes out, which is just like, some people like it, some people don't. Then, as you said, The Walking Dead, and then Mob City, which wasn't that well received either. So it may just be that he's one of these directors that had like two or three good ones in him, but hasn't quite been able to get back to that place since. So,
well, I disagree with the he had this many in him, because nobody's given him a job as far as I could tell. I mean, well, fairly certain that for in those 16 years, he probably had 20 different projects that he couldn't get made.
That's possible. Yeah.
I mean, like this is what's so weird to me is that Hollywood doesn't make any fucking sense at all, but there are all sorts of directors, you know, like the idea that he had one movie that's kind of a dud and then his career is struggling. There are all sorts of directors who have dud after dud after dud. There's like, you know,
box office wise, as you said, like, Shawshank didn't do well at the box office. Green Mile didn't do that well at the box office, even though people love that movie. And The Majestic didn't do well at the box office. So maybe the run of films, it was the box office stuff that made people go, well, maybe the public doesn't want his movies, you know, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, there's so many directors who have done so many fewer good movies than Frank Darabont that keep getting handed movies,
You know how to play the game. Justin Toner says, in my first Streamlabs, I listed my five favorite King films. Which ones most disappointed you because you loved the book? For me, they are The Dark Half and The Dark Tower. And I agree with Steve that the only way to do Dark Tower justice is as a TV series. Yeah, I agree with Steve as well. Steve. So disappointing adaptations, I guess.
I'm trying to think of a book that I really loved where I didn't like the movie. Because obviously The Dark Towers would be number one on that list.
Yeah,
but I'm trying to think of other ones, and nothing's jumping up to my mind that quickly.
Let me see. I'm gonna look through these. I like The Shining. I thought Cujo's Dead Zone, Christine, Stand By Me, Running Man. I guess Needful Things, but only because it's not a bad film. It's just that I think there was more to explore from the book. And I don't think they 100% got it right. So it was a little bit disappointing, but I wouldn't say I was disappointed. It was just a little disappointing. And so that's how I would look at that one. But other than that, I didn't read Secret Window or 1408. So I don't know how to judge that one. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
You know what it just occurred to me is that, which is obvious, but I never thought of it quite in this way, is that the good Stephen King movies, and I would say in the good adaptions of stories, either it comes from a short story where the filmmaker fills things out and adds it. And that's Stand By Me and Shawshank, and probably Apt Pupil as well. Mm-hmm. You know, but the Stand By Me and Shawshank being the two that are really, really good.
A Long Walk as well.
Yeah, exactly. Where it's like, oh, we have this crux of an idea, and then we can use that to explore the human condition in all these other ways.
Yeah.
Long Walk's a perfect example. Or we have a big story that we pared down, and that's Misery. Misery is really the mastery of William Goldman and Rob Reiner to figure out what not to include and how to simplify that story into making it just a perfect, perfect movie. You know, that's where it seems to really work.
I know it's not a Stephen King film, but Silence of the Lambs, I think, is very, very much like your Misery.
Oh, totally.
Comparison, you know, because that book is incredible. And there is so much in that book. What they pare it down to is a great movie, but the book is a whole completely different experience. And so they got it right, and that's what's important. So Dreamcatcher was a terrible adaptation. I agree. Hawaii 2000. All right, those are all the questions, brother. Let's wrap it up. We're almost at half an hour and a half, so we usually wrap up around 90 minutes. So what are your final thoughts here as we walk away from the Stephen King adaptations for now, because I'm sure there will be future Cinephiles episodes on Stephen King movies.
You know how we have now parasocial relationships where you follow someone on social media and you just feel like they're a part, like for instance, Marc Maron, who I've literally been listening to since 2011 or 12, and he's just about to end his show. And I have been with him listening to almost every episode that whole journey. I have a parasocial relationship with Marc Maron. I know the foods he likes. I know when he's stressed. I know stuff that's going on. Of all authors, I think I have the greatest parasocial relationship with Stephen King. He's been a part of my life for decades, and particularly from things like reading On Writing over and over again, which is very personal. And then when he comes, I won't go into details, but he makes an appearance in the Dark Tower series And so, and then because I follow him on social media and I read articles that he writes, and I really love his philosophy of writing, the guy's an important part of my life. He's like a family member, you know? Yeah. And so I, you know, I kind of going like, man, he's still fucking at it. And I know I'm going to buy a new Stephen King book next year, probably, and listen to another one. And it's going to be really weird when he's not around. It's kind of what I'm suddenly feeling. It's part of my family.
Well, I come at this from a different angle. Stephen King has always been in my life. I don't think he's quite had the impact, of course, as Steve so eloquently said just now, but I've always just had Stephen King. I've always known Stephen King since I was a young kid to now. He has always, that name has always resonated for me because I discovered so many interesting things about the human condition and about him as a, and about horror through his books and about humanity through his books. And I really appreciate that. As a guy who is constantly afraid of many things in the world, and I am, I don't mind admitting that, he captures the power of fear and terror so well, so viscerally in his books, that there's almost a sense of comfort in that and a sense of being seen, as the kids like to say nowadays, when you read his books. And I appreciate that. And I think that's why his books still appeal to so many people, or people go back and read those books, because the stories feel so universal in their own way and fascinating in their own way. So I love that people are still discovering his stuff. I love that people still wanting to adapt his stuff, as we just saw with The Long Walk this weekend, and a new Running Man version coming out later that's supposed to be a little more closer to the book than the Schwarzenegger version, which I'm not surprised by. I'm curious to see how they're going to bring out the greatness of the Stephen King books in their adaptation. So, yeah, as Steve pointed out earlier, the Bible, Shakespeare, and Stephen King. That's a hell of a top three to be in, and that deserves all your respect, and certainly artists still love and respect his work, which is why he's still going today in terms of his writing and these adaptations. So, well, thank you all so much for joining us for these for this conversation.
We got a note that there's one last super chat, someone just posted.
I don't see it. Maybe it went out when my internet went out. Steve, I only have Vincent Zawada, Fretastic. Do you see any other super chats?
Vincent, why don't you, I see he said, would love Flanagan to remake Needful Things.
Oh, that's the, so absolutely. I think he's doing a series now, Flanagan. I can't remember what Justin was saying it, that he's, Flanagan is doing a series now that's adapting one of the Stephen King books. So him doing the Stand would be fascinating. Flanagan is an interesting guy. Not everybody likes Flanagan, but certainly he has a strong track record. Carrie, yeah. He's doing a Carrie adaptation. So yeah, it could be fascinating to see his version of The Stand for sure, which I think hasn't ever been done justice fully for me. All right, anyway, there you go. Thank you all so much. Thanks for the Streamlabs. Thanks for the Super Chats. Thanks for the lively chat here that we had from you all. And thanks to our patrons for the wonderful questions they asked us throughout this episode. Steve, what do we have to tell these wonderful people? And what do we have to tell them about the new benefits we're offering here?
Well, patreon.com/thecinephiles and Apple Podcasts are both great places to support the show. Through Apple Podcasts, you can get access to our shorts and ad-free versions of the show, but it's on Patreon that we have all the other tiers, including our advisory board, which helps to plot the course of the Cinephiles. And as you alluded to, our new features is that we're not just going to ask for questions from the $10 and above tier for the big movies. Now questions are going to be open for all the movies, and any questions we can't get to in our regular episodes, we're going to do a once a month review where we're going to get to all our questions, and maybe we'll even kind of use it as a month in review conversation. Like this is what's gone on in the world of film and the Cinephiles. And that too will be for the $10 above tier exclusively on Patreon.
Yeah. There you go. Great stuff. We're always thinking of ways to change things around and offer new things for you all. And also open to making adjustments within our own offerings on the page on Patreon. So highly recommend you all join it. It is worth every penny you spend, in my opinion, every penny you spend to support us here on the show. But even if you can't, thank you very much for being listeners. That's what we really appreciate at the bottom line, for being listeners for us every week, supporting our show every week by sharing it everywhere and telling people about it. You can follow me at The Roka Says on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and all their social media stuff. And please remember to subscribe to the channel down below and leave us your comments. What are your top Stephen King adaptations? What ones are disappointing to you? What ones really kind of fleshed out their original stories and did so much more with them? Let us know all of it and what Stephen King means to you now in 2025 when you listen to this. We'd love to hear from you. All right, for my partner, Steve Morris, I am John Rocha. This has been The Cinephiles Live, and we'll talk to you next time with another brand new episode next month. Take care until then. Go see The Long Walk. Peace.